Previously on Lost.
You cannot change anything. You can't. Even if you try to, it wouldn't work.
Why not?
Whatever happened.
Do you really think all this is an accident? That we, a group of strangers, survived? Many of us with just superficial injuries? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason. All of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Horse?
You know Nurse Cole.
You gotta find me, John. You gotta find me. And when you do, you'll find him.
Who?
Jacob.
Two players. Two sides. One is light. One is dark.
We have to go back!
We have to go back!
Hello and welcome to the Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast for Season 5, Episode 14, The Variable. And here's our question for this week. What was your dream career if Mama Eloise didn't force you into podcasting? My name's Dave Gonzalez, and I would like to be an FBI agent investigating the X-Files. That's the only kind of type of FBI agent I'd like to be, but I would like it really badly.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and I would obviously be a concert pianist playing as much Chopin as I want. Thank you very much, Mother.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I think one of my great dreams was always to be an astronaut. I was kind of too tall to be a pilot. Also, I just like to point out that I would have loved if my mom would have forced me into podcasting, because then it would have, I don't know, maybe worked out a little bit better at the beginning. It took me a long time to figure this thing out.
Basically, if she had gotten you a talk boy and was like, Neil, this is your future.
Yeah.
She could have prepped you. That's a Home Alone 2 Lost in New York reference. But you are listening to a podcast about Lost. If this is your first time joining us, welcome. This podcast is an ideal companion if you're rewatching the ABC series Lost with us or visiting the island for the very first time, because each episode comes in sections for your listening pleasure. First, we have a calm section that only discusses the preceding episodes and avoids all spoilers, and a second section called The Storm, in opposition to the calm. We would like to think we're not necessarily staying calm about this awesome episode of Lost ever. The Storm is a storm of spoilers, discussing this week's episode in the context of the entire series and over a decade of Lost fandom. Rest in peace, Time Daddy. If you look down at your podcasting device, you will see time codes listed for both The Storm and The Calm, so you could jump around or revisit as you see fit. But first, we got a little more keeping of this house to do. This once citadel of Crazy Town, now time-looped hatch of mild insanity. we'll workshop it. If you would like to support us besides just listening to the podcast, you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers, and there you can figure out how to subscribe to us for a monthly fee, and in return, we will kick you access to our bonus content. That is not only new bonus content every week, sometimes up to like three bonus podcasts, but also access to our Slack. You get to access all our old bonus content and posts and podcasts, and you get to do things like watch Lost with us on the weekends. It's super fun. Also, there's a bonus content podcast that was started with Joanna Robinson representing The Storm, and Kristen from Buffering, the Buffering podcast. And together, they decided to investigate movies that they both hadn't seen, with the other one sort of leading them through it. I'm doing a bad introduction, but feels like the first time is back. Joanna, what are you introducing to each other this week in podcast form?
Well, this month we have decided a sort of a grab bag of horrors. Two really work perfectly together, and then the third one is just dropped in there because I've never seen it and I really want to see it. So we've got Tremors. Ever heard of it? One of the greatest films of all time. So we'll be watching Tremors on April 28th in our joint Slack. We've got Army of Darkness, and here's why we're doing Army of Darkness. We'll be watching that on April 14th. And here's why we're doing Army of Darkness. Because Kristen literally does not know who Bruce Campbell is. She called him Skeleton Man for some reason. I don't know why. And Jenny, her buffering co-host, Jenny Owen Young's, let me know, and Kristen let me know that she had no clue who Bruce Campbell was. So I felt like Army of Darkness is the best way to introduce her. That, and maybe I'll make her watch an episode of Xena to introduce her to the glory that is Bruce Campbell. But yeah, or maybe Bubba Hotep. I don't know. We'll get wild. But we're definitely watching Army of Darkness, a movie I saw 1 million times in high school, thanks to my friend Charlie. Okay, and then lastly, right, the meat in the middle of this genre hunk sandwich is The Covenant. Which is this movie about that I've heard described as Abercrombie and Witch. It's about a bunch of boys who are witches. And we've got Tim Riggins from Friday Night Lights and Sebastian Stan. Ever heard of him? From Falcon and the Winter Soldier. So amongst other hunks. So we will see. I have heard that this is a very fun, very bad movie. And I'm excited to see. I think they're on the swim team, so they forever have their shirts off. So it's going to be a really, really good time, I think.
Wow.
So Haunted Hunks is what Kristen is calling this series, and it kicks off April 14th, Army of Darkness, April 22nd, The Covenant, April 28th, Tremors. You can come join us in our joint Slack, which you can find out about through our Patreon, patreon.com/stormofspoilers. So that's that. We also this month have a book club, and by the looks of it, this is going to be a huge book club, because every day I hear about someone else in our listenership reading Shadow and Bone, the Leigh Bardugo book that's being turned into a Netflix series, which debuts at the end of the month. I read Shadow and Bone. I've also read Six of Crows, which is way better than Shadow and Bone, and is also part of the adaptation that they're doing for Netflix. That's like another book she wrote in another series with the same universe. So Six of Crows, Shadow and Bone, do yourself a solid. The audiobook for Six of Crows, here's a tip to you, is a multi-voice cast recording, which is always super fun. So I really recommend both Shadow and Bone and Six of Crows, but actually more Six of Crows than anything else. So we will be doing that right after a Lost finale watch later this month. Hold on, I've forgotten where our notes are. There they are. Okay. So we'll be doing that on April 10th. So this Saturday, April 10th. So maybe you don't have time to cram two books in, but you can try. Right after our live watch of Follow the Leader, which our producer Diana is leading the Slack. So at 3 o'clock Pacific, you can watch Follow the Leader. And once we figure out what happened there, who died, who's kissing, we don't know. We'll find out. At the end of that, you can pop over into a Zoom chat that we're having about Shadow and Bone. Sounds like fun, does it not? These are the good times we have in the Storm of Spoilers Patreon Slack. So patreon.com/stormofspoilers, as I mentioned, is where you can find out more info about all of that, or go to stormpodcast.com. You can find us on Twitter at stormpodcast. You can email us, host@stormpodcast.com. And you can always, always, always leave us reviews. We had 4 new reviews this week. Thank you so much. I'm just going to read 2 of them. The first one is titled Don't Miss This from Rachel Warren, 89, 5 stars. Rachel says, Dave, Neil, and Joanna make my Wednesday. Not only do they do a great job of recounting the series, both in context of its time and through our contemporary lens, but the community they've created around this podcast has provided me 2 escapes. 1, I was in a really dark time having made a bad career move. I found the podcast and felt immediately connected to the 3 hosts as if they were just 3 friends talking Lost with me instead of counseling through my dark time. 2, a worldwide pandemic. Joanna is particularly impactful to me as I too have been accused of being quote unquote too much in my own life and in my career. She demonstrates how we must continue to take up space. I also really appreciate how fun Dave and Neil are. They make really sensitive and potentially problematic situations much more palatable. Never tighten up. Also, when you're done with Lost, please consider doing a rewatch of The Leftovers, Breaking Bad, and a million other shows. I'll pretty much give anything a try that you all want to cover together as a team. So, thank you, Rachel. That is a binding legal contract promise you just made, and no matter what we watch next, even if it
it'll
is like
great.
Haunted hotels,
all the Godzilla Showa movies,
just the dustiest British things,
Shitland, you have to watch it with us. All right, this next review comes from Gwendy, 5 stars, and it's titled "A Reviewer That Doesn't Hate Joanna." I started rewatching Lost in Quarantine last year as a way to virtually meet up with friends. After a few episodes, I realized how much I had forgotten since I first watched the series about 5 years ago. An Apple Podcast search brought me to Joanna, Dave, Neil, and their stormy goodness. I'm only at the end of season 3 of my rewatch, but each podcast episode has helped remind me of bits I missed and increase my understanding of the series as a whole. I was really pulled in with the most 2005 thing and loved the corner bits. I also think Joanna's really great with the guest interviews. I was going to save my review for when I caught up with the rewatch, but let's just flash forward and imagine I love the other episodes too. Gwendy. So Gwendy must be in a point in season 3 where we were getting a lot of "shut up, Joanna" reviews. So thank you all so much for your reviews. We really appreciate them. They do, like, they put us on the radar of folks who are just idly searching for a Lost podcast mm-hmm. to listen to. It helps us get on their radar, and then helps grow our community, which is something that we love to do. And then I'm going to hit you with a couple emails before we head into the discussion of the episode proper. Let us start with Andrea has a question about Charles Widmore's money. She says, "Hi guys, your podcast is the highlight of my Wednesday, so thank you for creating this wonderful show. Here is my question. How do you think Charles Widmore made his money? I've been thinking about this a lot during this rewatch, and after watching the latest episode, I want to write and ask your thoughts. Did he make his money after being banished from the island? Was there already a network of people on the mainland working with the others, or do you think that is something that Ben set up as leader? Thanks, Andrea." I have a theory, but I want to hear first what Neil thinks.
I mean, I think he went back to the mainland and sold those scarves and, like, patented it. That patent is what he used to build his empire. No, I mean, I definitely think he did it after, or I guess while he was, out there having a daughter and, you know, cheating on the island with the mainland, he must have been doing some business deals. But, I don't know if I have any good. I mean, I think, I also do think it's true what they said about, like Ben and his people setting up their own off-island operation at some point. You know, that probably started after Ben wrestled everything away from Charles.
All right, Dave?
Family money. That's how Ooh. All evil rich people just, like, do it. Like, could you imagine being, like, this rich, young Charles Widmore in the 50s, and you can do whatever you want, and you're like, "No, Dad, I'm not taking over the family money. I'm gonna search for my fortune in on the oceans." And then you end up on the island and you have your whole worldview shifted, and then you come back as an adult and you're like, "Hey, Dad, what's up? Give me my money."
So Charles Widmore is a fail son? I actually buy that.
Are you saying like joining the Dharma initiative, or no, joining the others is like doing the Peace Corps?
Right.
Yeah, basically. It's like his version of the Peace Corps.
Okay. He came back and he's like,
"I'm ready for industry now. I've seen the realities of the world and I'm ready for industry."
My theory is that but we find out that Eloise gets wait, should we cut that? Okay, let's see what else we want to discuss. Oh, that's it for emails, actually. All the rest of our emails are stormy, and so we've got a good number of emails to read in our storm section. So that leaves me with just one question, which is, Neil Miller, what happened mm-hmm. on Lost this week?
Oh, I can't wait to tell you. It was a wild ride this week on Lost. This episode, The Variable, was directed by Paul Edwards and written by Edward Kitsis and Adam Horowitz. You've heard their names before. This episode aired on April 29th, 2009, after the show took a week off and aired a recap special. This whole thing takes place 4 days after the arrival of Ajira Flight 316 on the island. In flashbacks, we learn about Daniel's life and how he went from being a sweet little boy who just wanted to make time to play piano to a full-on time daddy. We also learn that it was Charles Widmore who funded Dan's research in college, Charles Widmore who recruited him for the freighter mission to help fix his timey-wimey brain issue, and Charles Widmore who is, in fact, Dan's father. We also learn about his mother, how his mother Eloise wanted to keep him focused on his destiny, for reasons that we'll talk about here in a minute. Off island, Eloise shows up at the hospital where Desmond is being treated for his Ben-inflicted gunshot wound. She's there to apologize for her role in Desmond's fate, only to find that Desmond is totally fine and Charles Widmore is just lurking outside the hospital for some reason. On the island, Time Daddy Dan has returned from Ann Arbor just in time for things to completely fall apart for our Dharma Losties. After telling Dr. Chang that A, he's from the future, and B, Miles is his son, Dan convinces Jack and Kate to run out into the jungle in search of his mother, the Other, so that they can all figure out a way back to their own time. But before they can leave Dharmaville, Dan also has to have a talk with baby Charlotte, that's very weird, and they have to have a gunfight with Radzinski. Knowing that their cover is blown, the rest of our Dharmaville crew prepare to escape back to the beach, but not before Sawyer and Juliet are captured by Radzinski and his Dharma cops. It all ends with Jack, Kate, and Dan reaching the Others, and after a brief but tense standoff with Richard, Daniel is shot in the back and killed by his own mother. He dies revealing that he is her son. Fun fact about this one, this is the 100th episode of Lost, which is significant in American television because it means you can go into syndication. Although it's worth pointing out that Lost had already been in syndication prior to hitting 100. It's one of those special exceptions because of how popular it was. This week's calm question for you guys. Would you have been, let's say that you're in the meeting where LaFleur and Juliet, Hurley, Jin, Miles, everybody's decided. Oh, Jack, I guess he was there too. Are deciding what to do. Would you have been on Team Sub Escape or Team Beach Rebuild? Let's start with Dave.
I feel like I've already said I've been wary of going off island in the 1970s. That being said, when they go and they're like, you know, we're going to go wait for you at the beach, like catch up with us, I'm like, the beach was less than one season away from the Swan Hatch where all, like, evil Radzinski is. So I don't think the beach is far enough away. So I think I'm going to be Team Sub-Escape in this one.
All right. Joanna?
As LaFleur goes, so goes my nation. I'm going on the sub. I'm not following Jack into the jungle, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that even though Jack has rediscovered his confidence here in this episode, I don't think that I'm going along with any of Jack's plans, because you know what? LaFleur has been doing a really good job for a while.
Except for like the last hours.
The situation where he, instead of like kissing Phil, he punched him and kidnapped him. You know, it's just one mistake and it'll get you.
Could have solved that with a kiss.
We're in one of my favorite type of episodes, which is a time travel episode that involves all the pieces of time but doesn't actually involve like time machines or jumping through time. It's ye old time travel story with the
would you say that tragic... it's like a time travel consequences episode.
It is. It's like a time travel consequences episode. It's very La Jetée-esque or 12 Monkeys, as we've established, are the same thing. But it's sort of like building to the last scene as a punchline and using... I mean punchline as, I guess, climax. Punchline makes it sound like it should be funny. It's not funny. But to a climax. And it does it in a way that not a lot of Lost episodes necessarily operate its way, but a lot of good time travel fiction does, where as soon as the episode ends, if you go back and you watch all the flashbacks and you get to watch Eloise go through it, knowing now what she's known her entire life, that she shoots her son in the back, it is heartbreaking. And it's so much fun to have an episode that plays on those two levels, I think, so immediately. Sometimes, you know, if long-form storytelling is well-planned out or is fortunate, you could look over back in an entire series and be like, oh, here's some things I didn't miss that were being acted out all the time. Because Lost is a living show and is being written in between seasons and everything else, they have a vague idea of where they're going. Really, it gets distilled down into episodes like this, and I think just think it's really masterfully done. There almost isn't a wasted second, even though I'm not into a lot of the running around on the island when there's suddenly a six-hour ticking clock. But in terms of television, Lost is like, hey, how long has it been since we had a shootout? So we get an action sequence thrown in the middle of the episode. All in all, maybe one of my favorite episodes of Lost, and definitely the episode that cemented Daniel Faraday as one of my favorite characters. Neil, did you have trouble trying to prep people for Daniel Faraday and then, like me, I think, realize that he kind of like takes some time off in season five and then comes back and dies?
Yeah, I mean, Dan, as we've discussed, I think, previously about how they really did have bigger plans for Dan sort of before they got interrupted by, I think, the writer's strike. They had bigger plans for a lot of our freighter crew. But I think this is one example where even with, I mean, he starts really strong and then he sort of goes away. And then what an amazing way to close out, you know, Dan's time travel related story arc than to have him be the, you know, this great line. And Jeremy Davies gives such a wonderful performance in this episode, but in my mind, it's none better than the moment where like Jack has just finished patching him up. And he's talking about, like, really, Jack, like, this is our present. Any of us could be killed. And there's just such a, like, deep, like, ethereal, sort of spaced out, like, sadness about it. Where it's like, this guy's, you know, brain is obviously, he's got cosmic brain in general. And he seems genuinely like, I don't think this is going to go well for me. And so I love it. And I think that it's a great finish for Dan. It's such an amazing close. I mean, we've talked about how Lost loves an act break and Lost loves to close with a big shocking moment, but this might be the best one. This is an all timer.
Joanna, I believe we both own a shirt that praises our two time daddies.
Yeah,
well, there's a time daddy and then the constant, who ironically is the variable, which is Desmond. But this episode gives us little bits of both. How much do you think they're consciously throwing to each other?
Well, I think, you know, they obviously named this the variable so that we would think about the constant and think about Desmond and Dan as two sort of interconnected time travel buddies. And they're, I don't know if Desmond put a ring on it, but if he did, they're brothers-in-law, so that's fun.
Oh, I never thought of that before.
Time brothers. But I don't know, it's...
Did, because they call Penny Mrs. Hume at the end of this episode.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. All right, so time brothers-in-law, Daniel and Des. They consciously throwing to each other. I don't know. I do think it's really, really so beautifully suiting that Dan is the victim of a causal loop, given how interested in time he is. Something I said at the end of last week's episode was to like have people watch and count all the references to time and Dan's dialogue. And there's so many. It's just sort of like, you know, I'll be back in a minute, or like, you know, I can make time is the more overt one. Maybe let me see if I can collect some more to read out to you guys later. But I think Des feels a little shoehorned in here. I think he's in here because they want us to be thinking about the constant. But it is, of course, a relief to the audiences to see that he's alive. And for to know the added significance of Eloise talking to Penny presumably being, like, we have to guess that given that Charles got kicked off the island for having an affair with a woman off island, that like that constitutes some kind of betrayal to Eloise, who he had another baby with. So Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly where in the timeline that works. That would have been later. Or how old Dan is supposed to be and how old Penny is supposed to be. Because Dan, I think, is supposed to be 30, which is actually a little younger than how old Jeremy Davies was when the show was airing. But I don't know how old Penny is supposed to be and whether or not Charles cheated on Eloise to father Penny or what exactly happened. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. I mean, this is also an interesting one. Do we think that Dan Faraday was born on the island?
So I'm looking at the Lostopedia page for Eloise to try to throw this into a thing. But it says, at a later date, likely 1978, having left the island, Eloise gave birth to Daniel, as Daniel has a birth certificate.
Oh.
I still count him as an island baby. I think he and Miles and Charlotte are all...
Sure.
qualify as island
well,
babies.
Well, if he was an island baby, his nose would have started bleeding.
No, I'm not saying...
Well, he was conceived on the island.
I just think, like, an island baby not in the way that, like, his nose would bleed earlier, but an island baby in the fact that, like, his fate is linked to the island.
Yes.
That's what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. But I was he conceived on the island? I mean, I would assume mm-hmm. so, because that's yes. the time that, like,
yeah,
Ellie and Charles
right.
would be together. So it would have been, like, right as Charles would have had to be in the island, and Ellie would have had to leave pretty soon afterwards. So when did... do we have any context clues as when he was booted by Ben?
Well, Ben's older. Mm-hmm. Ben's played by Michael Emerson when he gets booted. So it's significantly after. We don't know how old Penny is. Like, he said you fathered a child off island, but we don't know when he fathered that child off island.
Sure.
Right. But I mean, that also, oh, that really fucks up the timeline. All right. Because, like, if he gets booted off the island and Eloise is on the island and Dan's conceived on the island, then that doesn't that also put, does Eloise leave before Widmore is kicked off the island by Ben?
I think so, because I think, this might be a gentle spoiler, but we will know this very soon. I think at this point, Eloise is the leader, and then Charles becomes the leader. So if I had to guess, I would say
Eloise leaves
to have Dan, because maybe it's safer off island, or she's had it with Charles or whatever. And then Charles becomes the leader, and then Charles gets kicked out, and then Ben becomes leader.
Yeah.
Cool. So, I like that.
And Lostpedia sort of pegs the expulsion of Charles Widmore as being sometime after 1992.
Right.
So Penny would have definitely been born by then. I mean,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Just, yeah,
and Dan.
Yeah, both of them would have been alive by then.
Because Charles is the one who's there when Ben takes Alex, and Alex is a teenager. So everybody, anyway. So yeah, okay, so that sounds like, if I have my timeline correct, Eloise could have left the island to have Daniel because whatever mystery thing that happened between baby Ethan and the current timeline, the 2000s, where having children is dangerous, happens in that time period.
Sure.
Right? That would seem like an assumption we could make.
Could be.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Good job. I love timeline discussions. I love time travel episodes. This is almost as satisfying as Who's in Charge of the Others, which I think, you know, eventually in the storm, we're going to crack that one.
Yeah. Daniel's time loop death. It also just, I find it a very satisfying death, not in the way that, like, because I love Dan, so I'm not, like, thrilled to see him off the show or anything like that. It just feels like inevitable. Like Thanos.
Yeah. Well, and it's so deeply tragic, right? Yeah. Like, when you finally realize that she had been living with that knowledge this entire time and still sent her son to that island, it's so sad. Like, I feel like, because we don't know a lot about Eloise yet, right? We haven't had a ton of time to get to know her, just in these, like, little moments where we meet her in different positions, different places in her life. Mm-hmm. But just to know that sort of recontextualizes a lot of what we've seen from her, especially as an adult, especially as she's like helping these people. Like, she's doing all of this with the knowledge that, like, it's all leading up to her son jumping back in time and her killing him. That's right. So wild.
And is that like, is that sad and poignant, or because it seems like at the time, reading, like I always do, I read recaps mm-hmm. that came out at the time, like, people were like, why wouldn't she try to avoid it? And, you know what I mean? Like, that's usually how these causal mm-hmm. loops happen, is the person is trying to do everything they can to avoid their predestined fate. And in doing so, I mean, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy, sort of.
Sure.
Like, and in doing so, stumble into the fate itself. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah,
Eloise is just making a beeline for that fate. You know what I mean?
I think the right question is to, and I don't know if this is something we'll be able to figure out, but what is it about her time on the island that made Eloise such a firm believer in the destiny of people, you know, sort of whose lives intersect with this island, that where she really is like super hardcore. I'm going to make sure Dan doesn't get distracted by playing piano, and make sure that he gets to this moment. So I think it makes me want to know a lot more about Eloise's life on the island prior to killing her son.
Yeah, it's super tragic, especially in an episode where Dan's like, no way, no, like, whatever happened didn't, you know, necessarily happen. Which I want to clarify a little bit, because Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse clarified it on the official podcast. So I'm going to skip ahead to the official podcast check-in. But they mentioned that, remember back when we were skipping through time, that Sawyer was like, you know, let's go back and do this. And Dan's like, no, it hasn't happened yet. You know, like, you can't change things. Whatever happened, happened. And he gives this example of this, like, a river, and you throw a pebble into a river and it doesn't, like, change the flow of the river. There was originally an extended version of that scene that apparently Jeremy Davies is very good in, where he's like, but if you throw a boulder that's, you know, half the size of the river, it might be possible to divert the river. So, apparently, Lost isn't changing its rules of time travel. It's still living by the, I think, Desmond flashes before your eyes rules, which is that time's going to try to correct, but you could sort of, like, wiggle around it a little bit.
Mm-hmm. But also, I guess, Eloise knowing that this happened proves that it she always killed her son, right?
Yeah. Like,
so, and no matter what Dan tries to do, the only person that knew this, I guess, was Eloise. So I still think it fits with what happened, because at least for Eloise, she definitely always killed her adult son.
I mean, I think Charles also knew the whole time, right?
Sure.
You assume Eloise at some point would tell Charles, and that's why Charles is, you know, like, funding his research and making sure Dan gets to the island,
well,
and playing the dad, the bad dad, the good bad dad.
Another possibility, and we won't, I guess this is not, we never find out for certain if this is true. But, like, a possibility is that we are looking at a very similar scenario to Arrival, right? Where, like, Amy Adams' character, spoilers for Arrival, Amy Adams' character, like, sees a future and knows her child is going to die of some, like, rare, incurable disease. And she goes ahead and has the baby anyway. And when her husband, played by Jeremy Renner, you know, finds out that she knew in advance that the kid would die and did it anyway and didn't tell him, he gets mad at her and their relationship falls apart. And so I can see, you know, if Eloise tells Charles she's pregnant and she knows she's seen the future, or she knows the future and she's going to wind up killing the son, like, he might say, like, then we shouldn't have this baby, or, like, we should do mm-hmm. everything to stop. You know what I mean? Like, I can see him in the Jeremy Renner position in that instance. This is all speculation because we never know.
Sure.
For certain.
I like that we've now switched to, like, a world where Eloise is hard island and Charles is, like, soft island. Like, Eloise is like, no, we have to do it, and Charles is like, maybe I can have a kid off island. Like, the rules are kind of So maybe Charles isn't as evil as we thought he was.
Or he is also, like, of a true believer. You know, his I think that, like, the only other that we've seen so far who seems to just like not truly buy into all of the island stuff is Juliet, right? Like, she's the only person that's like an other who's like, I'll switch teams. I don't care. Like, I'm done with these people. And I think that's because she came along so much later. But all these other people, it's like, you know, they're very, very into the island. They would get along really well with John Locke.
It's a head scratcher of an episode, but I do like the things that Joanna's kind of poking at the edges here, where it's like Eloise knew it causes some sort of weird friction with Charles. Charles has a little affair, and they split up, like basically having nothing to do with each other except knowing that they're going to like have to collide in some sort of weird future situation. I mean, like, yeah, because if Charles knows, then like everything seems weird, because like how much are you really searching for the island if you know eventually when your son is X years of age you're gonna find the island and send a freighter to it?
Maybe he's searching for the island so that he can stop what's gonna happen to his son.
Proactive Charles.
Wow. That would be a very good dad behavior from someone who has otherwise been a pretty bad dad so far.
Has otherwise been a bad dad. So we love Daniel, but he does, I think, in the nature of our... Thank you. Yes, of course. As I'm just about to bring it up. In the nature of looking through things with a contemporary lens, does some creepy things here. Number one, kind of creeps on baby Charlotte, which we understand, love like throughout time, died in her arms.
Is it creepy?
Yes. He scared her because she remembers being scared of him. So
calls
yes,
her sweetheart,
he's creepy.
Which feels like, you know, I don't know. What would, like, say you met the younger version of yourself, the younger version of someone you had. I've been watching this a couple times recently, that interaction, and I'm like, how do you not make that creepy? How would you, Neil,
mm-hmm.
approach a girl that you had a crush on when you're the same age? You see her when she's younger. You have to tell her something. What is your demeanor like? How do you treat her?
I mean, I don't think it's terrible the way Dan approaches it because I mean, I would treat them like a child, you know, use the same kind of like child language that I would with any other kid. I probably just wouldn't. There's like nothing. There's nothing that anyone would be able to convince me about my destiny that would make me want to try this. But Dan's in a weird place, and also, I don't know. I think what complicates it is that it's like, this is the thing that Charlotte told him. So it's almost like he's like,
this is his causal loop that he causes by pretending yeah. to prevent it.
And it's almost like, do you feel like Dan feels obligated to keep the continuity of Charlotte's life timeline in the end? Like, why do you think Dan does it?
Because he's trying to save her. Because he's like, like telling himself, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it.
Exactly.
And then he does it. I did it. So like, you know, I think the idea of like needing to warn her to leave outweighs,
yeah,
you know, what he sees as a violation of the time rules. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I think if he's going to run around yelling he's from the future, go to the parents. Like, why? You're putting a lot on little Charlotte there, right?
I guess that's true. Listen, but then you're just like a really crazy guy who's very interested in a child, and
you,
the parents
came,
are going to be like,
you
what
came
is
from
your
Ann
deal?
Arbor with a super secret jumpsuit and a swan patch on it, and you're a physicist. Like, I feel like people, like, I feel like a lot of people should be taking Dan more seriously than they are here. But yeah, I feel like you could have gone to the parents.
Okay. I mean, that's not a terrible idea. I would rather try that than scare a child. I mean, honestly, if I were Dan, I would have just skipped that part. I would have just been like, you know what? Let's see what happens.
Yeah, worst case scenario,
right?
You know, she just suddenly stops existing because I undo sure. all of time. Well, by, like, and
that's the other thing is, like, he's already seen the end of Charlotte's present, right? So he lived with Charlotte in her adult life. So telling Charlotte, not telling Charlotte, it really kind of doesn't matter. Right, in the grand scheme of things, because if his theory of time travel is true, if whatever happened is true, if Dan just skips the whole thing where he talks to Charlotte, the universe is going to find a way to correct Charlotte's life to get her back to where she's on the freighter crew.
Yes. Right?
So, I don't know. If it were up to me, I think I would test the theory and just be like, well, let's see if the universe can correct for that. I'm not going to go traumatize the tiny human version of someone I dated and loved as an adult.
Well, yeah. And as I mentioned earlier in passing, Dan does says we're 6 hours out from this incident where there's going to be a pocket of energy they drill into in the Swan. It's much bigger than the one that just stretchered one dude. It's the same charged up spot that sucked a filling through some poor guy's brain last week. It's going to be a big thing. But in order to change that, he's going to detonate a nuclear bomb that's going to stop that, neutralize the energy, I think is the way that he put it, which, as his pitch is to Kate and Jack, will sort of undo this rolling set of hatch-based coincidences that end with the plane landing on the island. So if he's planning to do that, he's still planning to detonate a nuclear bomb on the island. So I get why you're telling Charlotte to leave. Is he not worried about his mom also being on that island when the bomb goes off? Or are we seeing a extremely abbreviated plan that Faraday's putting together?
He never got to explain that part of the plan.
He saw a picture of Hurley and Jack and Kate in Ann Arbor, and he's like, oh my god, they're back. And then he got on the sub, and as he's doing his nightly reading over of his notebook just to go back over things, he's like, oh my god, I'm gonna show up 6 hours before, like, the incident, like, I'm not gonna have any time. So he just has to get straight to work. I guess I could deal with that. It just does make Dan frazzled in a way that is different, I think, from his constant confidence. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense? Am I reading something weird into it, Joanna?
No, I think you're right. But also you have to bear in mind that in the constant, by the time we got to the constant, his brain is not fully healed at that point, I think. It's on the mend. The constant is sort of when it starts really healing itself, I think, because he anchors himself to Desmond there. Right? That's mm-hmm. my reading of it. So
nice. Oh, so he heals after the constant, not just by being on the island, which actually also makes me feel better, because I did have a question about how, if the island's supposed to be the thing that sort of keeps him even keel after his time experiments, how he's able to sub off for such a long time in the 70s. But if it's the idea that, like, I'm thinking about it way too linearly, and it's absolutely like a greater time expansion healing, that makes a lot more, that makes me feel better. Thank you, Joanna.
I'm so happy to do that for you. I mean, I don't know, maybe people will disagree. Please email us hostofstormpodcast.com, because it might be that, you know, his brain was healed the same way John's back / legs were healed. But I feel like I still have issues with Desmond as Daniel's constant, but but I think that that's what the show wants us to think, that that moment really did a lot to anchor him, his time-skipping brain. And I think the time-skipping brain thing is, like, I think that's we're meant to understand that that's why he's crying about the plane crash,
mm-hmm.
Because his brain has skipped through time and realizes that this is connected to him somehow. Do you know what I mean? We go back mm-hmm. to that.
Oh, yeah.
Previous season event. All right, you guys, are you guys ready for a dramatic reading of all the overt mentions of time in this episode of Lost?
No, yes, yes, we are.
Okay. We'll start with Daniel Faraday. It's Dan, Eloise, and Sawyer are the three people who have a lot of time-centric lines in this episode. Dan says, "Hey, Miles, long time no see." And then he says, "We don't have time." And then Eloise says, "So, unfortunately, there's no time, Daniel." And then she says, "You're not going to have time for relationships." And then Dan says, "Right on time. I'll be back in 10 minutes. In about 6 hours, the same thing's going to happen at the site for the Swan Station. I'm from the future. Dr. Chain, wait. Will you wait 1 second, please? Wait 1 second." Kate says, "How much time do we have before someone realizes he's gone?" Sawyer says, "Not enough." Sawyer says, hold on 1 second. Sawyer also says, "Time to go." Faraday says, "I'll meet you at the motor pool. I just need a minute, okay?" And then he says, "Hey, how long will it take us to get up there?" And then Faraday says, "We have no time." And Sawyer says, "That's ridiculous. Now just calm down for a minute." And Eloise says, "For the first time in a long time, I don't know what's going to happen next." And then Faraday, close to his last word, says, "I'm going to give you 3 seconds. One." And then he counts and dies. So a lot of time, increments of time mentions, and they do it pretty naturally in a really fun way. So shout out to Kitsis and Horowitz, I think.
I think, and the added layer of what I think is kind of fun about that is, like, most of those are people sort of saying that they have X amount of time and being wrong. Like, Sawyer's like, "We'll meet you there in a minute," but that's not true. Or, like, Dan never gets to the end of his countdown. Mm-hmm. It's just, I like it. I like
We're
it
out of time. We're out of time.
Yeah. Just everybody's, that time doesn't work the way we think it works, at least not all the time.
All this from the same script that finally brought us the one-line question, "Your mother is another?" Really,
I mean, just eventually someone's mom had to be another, right?
Yeah, I know. Really, I mean, there was a lot of potential to do it before.
I want to talk about this scene. The scene where Sawyer... Because I think that this is a scene that is great... And gets a little overshadowed by how amazingly well they pull off the end of this episode. But I love this sequence where it's Sawyer and the gang discussing, two big things. One, Sawyer's line, "I belonged here just fine until you came back, Doc," is amazing. Just crush Jack's soul while you're at it. It's awesome. But I think the all-star of this scene is Juliet, is Elizabeth Mitchell's face. Mm-hmm. Sitting
with her little coffee cup.
When LaFleur turns back into Sawyer for a second and calls Kate Freckles, and the whole game is off. And Juliet's like, "Yeah, okay, this is over. Like, we need to sort of move on this."
Dime, Frosty.
Yeah. And
Snow
I like
Lady.
I like that they haven't quite had time to work it all out yet. Because they got captured by the Dharma cops. But I just love the amount of tension that's in those few seconds as Juliet is making that decision. I think it's an absolute banger of a scene. And
go ahead.
Yeah, just right sort of in the middle of all this chaos, we get this incredible character moment that it feels like we've been building to, like, at what point will this all start to fall apart, and can the great couple of this show, LaFleur and Juliet, survive all this nonsense?
When he calls Kate Freckles, I like scream every time that he does it. And then I think Elizabeth Mitchell just like physically pivots with no expression
her
on her face, and she just goes, "The gate code is, you know, like blah blah blah." It's just like, it's so good. And then the follow-up scene between the two of them where, you know, he says, "You still have my back," and she's like, "Do you still have mine?" And in the unspoken parentheses are, "You son of a bitch." You know what you did, and he does know what he did. Like, he says,
oh, yeah.
He follows guiltily. So
great stuff.
Don't do it.
Meanwhile, we're pivoting with Jack and Kate to a new plot. Even though Dan didn't successfully negotiate with the others, it seems like other people could have maybe talked something out with Richard. We've seen that happen before. But instead we have Jack and Kate, who get the full explanation from Dan about the aforementioned neutralizing of the island. And at least it seems like to Jack, if he's judging his new circumstances and everybody came to the island for a reason, he certainly thinks he's there for a reason. This sounds to him like his reason. He can undo potentially all of his life, like by like starting a new point of like time. It seems like a great solution to Jack. Kate, who is here to find Claire, presumably, sort of already has her purpose and does not look as convinced that necessarily resetting a whole timeline is the best possible idea. Neil, mm-hmm. what do you think?
Well, I think it's clear that we're getting close to a finale because now we got a bunch of little groups and everybody's mm-hmm. sort of broken up. Because you have Kate and Jack who are now with the others. You have Hurley and Jin who are sort of got lost in the Dharmaville chaos, but we don't quite know what happened to them. And then we have Sawyer and Juliet who are captured, and you know Miles, I assume, is like just hanging out with his baby self. So I think that's important. But yeah, I think that it is interesting because Jack, what seems to have brought Jack's confidence back to life is the idea that he can sort of fix all of it, right? Because that was Jack's thing, is like he just can't let it go. He can't not try to fix stuff. So once Dan Faraday is like, hey, if we do this absolutely insane thing that I'm telling you, which is detonate a nuclear bomb on this island, it'll fix everything. And Jack's like, there it is. That's my shit. Let's go. Well,
and I think I'm going to save you, Boone.
I think it's one step beyond that. I think it's we're divided in people who... people for whom the last 5 years represents just regrets, and then people mm-hmm. who have a vested interest in preserving the last 5 years. Dave likes to talk about this a lot when it comes to Avengers Endgame and yeah. how Tony Stark doesn't want to make it that the blip never happened, because if he makes it that the blip never happens, then he never has his daughter, Morgan, right? Mm-hmm. And he just can't sacrifice that. So he's like, we gotta bring everyone back, but we can't.
We gotta traumatize half the world.
Yeah, let's not undo the blip. We gotta save my child, right? And so Kate's in a similar position. Like, she's helping Jack in this moment, but like, she doesn't want to blip away her time right? with Aaron. You know what I mean? And James and Juliet don't want to blip away this thing that they found with each other. But what the heck does Jack have to hold on to?
Right.
Nothing. And he's like, undo, control, alt, delete, get like, no, let's get rid of, you know, and for Dan too, like Dan wants to undo Charlotte dying. You know what I mean? So like these people mm-hmm. who are like, I can undo it. It's because they have nothing worth saving in those last few years. So that's sort of where the lines were divided on, and we'll see mm-hmm. if people flip flop over that line, because they might. But right now it's mostly Jack and Dan, and Kate's there, but I don't think she's fully on board with it. So yeah,
her facial yeah. expression says no, but also says like, I'm a good member to have on Team Jungle, so I'm going to stick in Team Jungle.
Yeah, I don't. It. She's I don't want useless you to get in the killed. Motor pool. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Kate's the easiest one to understand, like why she wouldn't want to reset the timeline, because not only would it blip away her time with Aaron and being a mother, it would. She'd also then have to go to jail, right? Yep. Like, cause she was She's on her way now, back yeah. to be going into jail. So I don't know, Jack.
I mean, I'm pretty nice. Sure she's violated her parole, but in the 70s, so...
That being said, like, Jack and Kate, as confident as they often are in the jungle, I think they're real shitty companions here. I really feel like James and Juliet would not have let Dan Faraday get shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean...
think they would have come out of the brush, guns blazing, and right? shot people before Dan got shot. That's what I think.
I think, yeah, like Sawyer's too protective over like too trying to keep everything together to let that happen. And Juliet is probably the most aware of the fact that you should not go charging into a camp full of others with a gun, right? Like Dan's plan was bad.
As soon as Kate gives him, Kate, don't give him the gun. As soon as she gives him the gun, I'm just sort of like, this is just countdown to bad times. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, and I think the whole 6 hours thing is something that I didn't really realize before, but the idea that Dan comes back and he realizes that you know, whatever the incident is, it is imminent. It causes him to stop thinking clearly about the rules, about the plan, and he begins to panic. And you know what? Panicking will get you shot by your mom.
Yeah, panics to the point where he goes from is like their more starter gun to just like, I'm going to walk into the camp by myself and
yeah,
do gun negotiations.
At least John Locke knew to walk with his hands up being like, I know Richard. And that's weird enough to where the others are like, all right, fine, let's talk to this guy.
Yeah, Daniel could have done the exact same thing. He was also there in that time period. He could have been like, remember where'd you bury the bomb that I told you to bury?
Right. And it's clear that Richard like kind of remembers him because Richard was there too.
Yeah. So it's just if Dan just hadn't had that gun in his hand. So let's cancel all guns. Better gun screening checks on the island.
There you go.
Is what I say. And we should note, I mean, once again, I don't know if this is flirting too much with spoilers, but Dan says it's 6 hours to the incident, right? Mm-hmm. Just to let you know, the two-part finale of the season is called The Incident Part 1 and Part 2. So
yeah,
we have a ticking clock, is what I'll say on that. So.
And luckily, it's even shorter than 6 weeks, which would be 6 hours. So we're gonna do some skipping.
Yeah,
which is important because presumably they have to like dig up a bomb or bury Dan. You know, there's a lot of digging ahead.
But
that
you know,
have to watch out.
You know who's not going to solve it? Dan, because he didn't.
Dan's not going to solve it.
Tough break.
Absolutely dead. We are not pulling a gin on you. Dan is dead this time.
Yeah, and he's not coming back like Locke. He's just what is dead is dead.
Also, shout out to Jin, who takes a principled stance on not leaving the island because he's still trying to find Sun. Reminder that Sun is still in the normal timeline, and that's pretty.
He has
dumb.
A baby too that he doesn't want to get blipped. You know what
right?
I mean?
Yeah, I mean, and I think, and you know, I don't know where Hurley's going to land on this, but I feel like Hurley's having a good time in Dharmaville and would probably prefer to stay.
Yeah,
Hurley
I'm trying
has
to think
a bad
what
time
Hurley
off
would,
island.
Hurley might lose more good dad time.
Sure. Reconciling with his dad, figuring out that he didn't need the lottery money. You know.
But this is the kind of story that I really respond well to. I think of it most with Arrival, but also with like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which is this idea of like, and they did it. Anyway, they knew and they did it anyway, which is just one of the most like beautifully like fragile human things to do, I think. Just sort of like, you know, pain is coming and you do it anyway. Eloise had her son anyway. You know what I mean? So,
yeah. Yep.
Yeah. It's a super powerful island. People really do stuff for the better of it, you know? And I guess, that's a hard question. If I was actually presented with a causal loop that would cause my own death or the death of somebody I really cared about, then I'd have to think about it beyond like Lost and Back to the Future, beyond pop culture. I'd have to be like, do you want to fuck with time, Dave? Like, everything you know says that time kicks back, but do you fuck with time? And Eloise is just like, no, don't fuck with time, which I respect that. If you're staring down the void of, you know, a world where there's a real island of magic and time is fungible. Ugh.
Yeah. Ugh. Well, Eloise Hawking, the all-time time respecter.
Yeah.
She even gets to be a time cop to flashy Desmond.
Sure.
Time mommy!
Time mommy!
Yeah, I mean, like I said, you just, there is something that makes these folks, your Eloise, Charles, Ben, believe so strongly in the destiny that this island has apparently orchestrated for them that it's pretty wild. I think that is a layer to the others that we don't really get until this late in the show. You know, previously it was just like, oh, these are the people who, you know, live on the island and had a falling out with the Dharma Initiative. But to get here to where it's like, no, these people are true believers. They believe that their destiny is intertwined with this island, and they won't even mess with time if given the opportunity. It's pretty wild.
And it takes their son and their daughter,
right?
Or their daughter's husband, and puts them in a hatch.
Yeah.
They'll do it all.
right? Also, shout out to Desmond and Penny for being in this episode basically just to make out at the end. It's great.
They've earned it at this after five seasons of that bullshit.
It also has been 8 episodes, I think, since we saw Desmond get shot.
Shot right in the milk.
It was in 316 that he gets shot. So what a long time to wait to find out if Desmond was okay for audiences. It's like 10 weeks.
I think we were too passe about him getting shot in the milk to really cause a lot of things. Sorry if we tipped our hand there.
Yeah, it was only audiences at the time were super stressed about it.
Right. And they thought that maybe Kate killed Aaron, too. Well, so it's like, ever.
It's funny because actually some of the recappers were like, oh, his injury looks more serious than I thought, because he gets shot and then he like has the energy to punch the ever-loving shit out of Ben Linus. And so I think some people were like, well, he can't have been shot that badly if he did all that damage to Ben. But I think that was one of those like mama bear.
Right, like lifting the car off your kid things.
Exactly,
yeah.
Situations. So, yeah.
Not my Charlie.
Not Charlie. Have you seen his hair?
All right, let's pick up some pieces before we head to the corners. Another thing I want to bring up, Dan makes some weird assumptions about Chinese Americans, which feels both accurate and the wrong thing to say. Just like
it's a real weird moment.
It is. Just like think about how just imagine Dr. Chang the chances that another Chinese American would show
up.
Well,
with your son's name is a better argument, but it doesn't start from a great place.
Yes.
Yeah. And I like that Dr. Chang is not having it.
Is this true? Right? No.
No.
Oh, Miles.
There's a wig in this episode, Joanna.
It's a top tier bad wig.
We've been building to it, apparently.
It's in the top three, for sure. Like,
which
the
is
other
just
contenders,
add more hair to Jeremy Davies.
The other contenders are one we haven't seen yet. And Jack's like little micro bangs that he had, I think, in like season 2 or something like that. But Jeremy Davies, it's baffling what they did with that wig, because it starts past Jeremy Davies' actual hairline, so they blended his like bangs into the front, and they're different colors. It's a different color. The wig is like kind of a purpley dark brown, and his natural hair is more of like a goldier darker brown, and it just doesn't match at all. Why did they do it? Why? So I hate it. Thanks.
It's always strange when we talk about like the terrible wigs on this show, and then you remember that like this is the biggest show of its time. This was the height of television in the years that it aired, and they still somehow got the bad wigs. It's like,
was wig technology that bad at the time? I have some questions.
I don't think it was. It's just one of those funny like pieces of the archive. It'll be like the coffee cup on Game of Thrones, where it's like, how did that even happen? Yeah. Like, how did they get terrible wigs on Lost?
Well, it's got to be that's the thing that they're not planning for, right? So they're like, we're on a show about a jungle, and maybe like some season we're also, you know, off island in a series of LA sound stages we can get. Not LA. They're on Hawaii sound stages we could get. So that's the works, but the stuff they're making up is like, oh, and then we see, you know, this character when he's blankety blank. So that's the ones that everybody has to like rush to put together for a production schedule, I'd imagine. And it comes down to they pick a wrong wig every once in a while.
So it bad. Yeah, maybe if they were in LA, this wouldn't happen. But since they're out in Hawaii, they're like, we can't get the right wig flown out here in time. So, oh, well. Can I talk about a Teresa crossover really quickly?
Sure.
I feel like they tried to make the whole Teresa thing feel better for us in this episode.
Because he tested out himself first?
Yeah, and also, like, he left her because he, like, couldn't take care of himself. You know, like, he himself was in shambles. Not just that he, like, straight up left his girlfriend in a coma. Also, I don't understand why he calls her Teresa. It really bothers me the way that Dan pronounces her name. Teresa is a name, but, like, no one else calls her that. It's weird. Anyway, I want to go back to a previous accent corner and tie it into a current Disney Plus show.
Oh.
So,
Minnesota, the Mighty Ducks.
So, when you'll recall that when Desmond was trying to hunt down Eloise, he goes through Teresa's sister. Do you remember mm-hmm. that?
Yes. And Widmore's paying her bills and stuff.
She had that lady had a wild accent. That lady is an actress named Imelda Corcoran. She was in Falcon and the Winter Soldier this week playing Selby, who also had a wild accent. super fun fact that someone on Twitter alerted me to. Imelda Corcoran is married to Victoria Alonso, who is like one of the head honchos at Marvel Studios. So she is Victoria Alonso's wife. So her accent work is not an issue here. In terms of so,
one of them produces a lot of Marvel stuff. The other one just does weird accents on TV shows randomly.
There you go. Okay. So shout out to that power couple. Yeah,
they seem fun. I would hang out with them.
Yeah, yeah.
another strike against Daniel, which was pointed out to us in our live chat, is don't get romantically involved with your research assistants. Definitely Absolutely. Don't test them. Test Absolutely. Things sure. on them. That's bad
don't do
for
it.
Sure.
Don't do it.
But don't get romantically involved with your research assistants. That's also not great. Daniel Faraday has some problematic relationships with women, namely all of them, but it apparently, you know, is varying degrees of his fault, because he's in this horrible time loop with a lot of them. All right. Did we miss anything in the column that we have to hit before we move on to the corners?
Just a quick Desmond Penny check-in. Like, the added context of, the added tension of Eloise talking to Penny, knowing that maybe she harbors some resentment around Penny's existence, mm-hmm. right? If Penny was at all, it's not Penny's fault, obviously, but like, you know, that's still an understandable bit of tension. And also, I think people got really nervous when Penny left Charlie alone. They're like, don't do it.
Yeah, yeah. You stay with the doctor. It's like, do not leave him alone with the doctor on this show.
Don't do that.
That could be Ethan.
Desmond says to Penny, I promise you, Pen, I promise I would never leave you again. That's not our obviously a lie award, but I'm just gonna put it on the map.
That's one of those you might want to make sure that your bank account's full before you write that check.
Exactly. I think that one's gonna bounce. So yeah.
That means it's time for corners. Neil, do we have a Giacchino corner this week?
We do. I guess we do. Giacchino, new track on this one, For Love of the Dame.
No.
Yeah, well, it gets worse. This is the track that plays over the conversation that Dan is having with child Charlotte. Which, as I've already established, I think he probably could have just skipped that item on his agenda and things would have been better.
Would
I think
it all instead of calling her sweetheart, would it be better if we called her, like, one tough dame?
Hey, tiny dame.
Hey, tiny dame.
Let me scare the shit out of you and traumatize you for your whole life, because you're going to come back to this island and die in my arms.
I'm telling your parents you're eating the chocolate.
No! I'm not allowed to have chocolate before dinner. All right, so Michael, one of our listeners named Michael wrote in about Giacchino Corner, and I don't think it's Michael Giacchino who wrote in.
No, if Michael Giacchino ever shows up on this podcast, I will eat one of Shannon's thong-toed shoes from season one.
We can say for the record that Michael Giacchino has turned me down for many interviews. If you ever hear me talk to Michael Giacchino, it will be...
Something happened. Something amazing miracle. Happened.
All right. So Michael wrote, hey there, love the podcast. Just thought I'd write in with a thought I've had for a while. It bothers me just a little that the Giacchino Corner is primarily about song titles and not about the actual music. It'd be so cool if you guys had musical moments from the episode to call out and maybe even play the clip. It's such a huge part of the show and you do call it out sometimes, but I'd love more music talk. Keep up the great work, Michael. So I can promise that I'll try to do a better job being on the lookout for musical moments. Mm-hmm. I'm not the best at identifying recurring motifs.
Sure.
My earballs don't work that way, but yeah.
In that vein, I do have a fun fact about this particular track. This is a mix of two different motifs. The sort of first movement of the piece, the early part of the piece, is Faraday's theme, but then it sort of has its own thing, and apparently at the end we get some of Mr. Echo's like action theme, from like way back in the archive. So the, you know, Mr. Echo is chilling with Hurley playing chess, and his music continues to be part of sort of the new threads. And I think that's one of the things I appreciate about Giacchino, is that like once he starts to identify the themes for each character, like he, especially in these later seasons, really sort of threads a lot of the early stuff back in ways that are unexpected. So I think there actually will be even more to talk about as we get into season 6.
Excellent.
Our jungle of mystery moment this week is, what is Dr. Chang supposed to do? Daniel's saying that he's just making sure that Dr. Chang's supposed to doing what he's supposed to do. What is that? Does that have something to do with this changing plan? I don't know.
Does it have anything to do with freaking out because somebody just told them that they're a time traveler? Because yeah, that's what I would do.
His hand?
Yeah, just not losing his hand. The Boone Carlyle Memorial Falling Down Award goes to Daniel Faraday, who's going to be winning a lot of awards this episode, his last episode where he can. Falls down, shot in the back by his mother. Womp.
It's a tough way to go. It's like the worst way to fall down, being shot in the back by your own mother.
it's definitely up there. Joanna, we have accent corners this week.
Oh, we sure do. Okay, so I tried to do Baby Charlotte. Little Baby Charlotte, who's not allowed to have chocolate before dinner. Sure. That actress's name is Maya Henson's, as far as I can... I mean...
Well, like the AIM scientist of Iron Man 3?
Henson's, two S's in the middle, okay. But very okay. Close. I think she spells Maya the same way as that character. Like the AIM scientist. What a thing to say.
Like Rebecca Hall, AIM scientist?
Rebecca Hall. I can't find much on Maya. I did find a Twitter account that's at Maya Henson's. Which is not, you know, H-E-N-S-S-E-N-S is an unusual name, at Maya Henson's. But that account has been suspended.
Oh.
Oh, no. So, was Baby Charlotte at the Capitol?
I think she was. That's what I've decided.
Baby Charlotte is cute.
Go, no.
Baby Charlotte is like, that's what you get for telling me I can't have chocolate before dinner. In my new America, I can always have fun. Chocolate before dinner. Okay, we have another one.
Okay,
we have middle Eloise Hawkins, right? Because we met baby Ellie, young Ellie, bomb Jughead Ellie, right?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously we've been spending a lot of time with Space Mommy Fiona Flanagan. Here we have middle range Eloise Hawking, 1970s through, I don't know, 90s, whatever. Played by Alice Evans. Where do you think Alice Evans is from?
Dave, you want to go first?
Australia.
Oh, okay. Australia. She actually kind of does a good Fiona Flanagan. Like, I'm gonna say she's British.
She's from Bristol, but here's a fun fact. Was married, Alice Evans was married to Ewan Griffiths, who played Horatio Hornblower as well as one of the Fantastic Four. And they have some kind of messy divorce going on. And I can't look it up right now because I don't have the mental bandwidth to do so. But Entertainment Weekly just ran a really hilarious headline that was something about like Titanic star Ewan Griffiths or something like that. And I'm like, yes, technically he's in Titanic, but that is not what I would call him. Titanic star Ewan Griffiths. And then I think it said like, and Lost actress Alice Evans. And I was like, yeah, once again, I guess she's on Lost a bit. Anyway, it's just, I love that when people look actors up to write them up and they have no idea who they are. So they're like, well, that's a famous thing that they were
That's
in.
A movie. That's the most famous one.
Right.
Titanic star.
Titanic or Fantastic Four. Well.
I have an accent corner addendum, and it's more of just a moment of praise because the actress who plays Teresa, like in that scene where Teresa meets Time Mommy, is I don't know if she's doing it as like she's putting on the accent, but there's she, it almost seems like she's doing a Rebecca Mader impression. Like she sounds very much like adult Charlotte. And I don't know if that's intentional.
Dan. All right. Like, do you want to accent corner Teresa?
Sure. Right. Cause it'll be fascinating to see if she's from a different place than Rebecca Mader. Cause Rebecca Mader is British, if I remember correctly.
I think she's,
Here we go.
Now we're in deep. Hold on. I'll look up Rebecca Mader.
Yeah. You look up Rebecca Mader while I figure out where Teresa is.
Cause we have, we've talked about her on.
Rebecca Mader, the extremist soldier from Iron Man 3.
yeah. Rebecca Mader, the actress, from Lost. Is from Cambridge, UK. So,
fun fact, Sarah Faruqi, which is how I'm choosing to pronounce this actress's name, was also in Iron Man 3.
She yes!
played a flight attendant.
Iron Man 3 Lost Nexus!
Iron Man 3 star Heather. Wow. You know, like people's about me on their web pages and how they're funny because you know that they wrote them themselves. In 2009, Faruqi shined in the television series Lost in the challenging role of Teresa Spencer, a patient who continually crosses time in her memories. The woman can be key in helping Faraday stop the island's erratic movements through time.
It really builds out a lot more backstory.
Yeah,
for Teresa.
That is a generous definition of that character.
Sorry, hey, much love to you. Much love to you, Heather.
Yeah, she was on Lost. Sarah. She gets to, you know.
Yeah, at least you weren't at the Capitol. You know, things have been worse this episode.
She grew up in London, the daughter of an Indian father and a German mother.
Ooh.
So, okay.
Interesting.
A real melange there.
Anyway, sure.
That's Sarah.
So close. Dan Faraday really just into the Cambridge accent.
He just likes that accent.
Yep. There we go.
The I married her coincidence corner is, of course, Eloise shoots her own son. I feel like anything besides that would be secondary. So let's just do it. I guess I'm out of the book club. We've got book clubs here. Okay. Books. Joanna, explain these to me.
Okay. Well, first of all, Sawyer calls Dan H.G. Wells, one of my favorite Sawyer nicknames of all time.
Oh,
right?
So he does.
H.G. Wells, you know, classic sci-fi author, time machine, etc. And then also, Charles Widmore picks up a copy of Wired, which everyone seemed to zero in on. I think probably because it's right around the time that the J.J. Abrams guest edited Wired came out, so like Lost fans were tuned into Wired. But this is this was like interesting edition of Wired where they called it like the supernatural sci-fi sort of edition, and like talking about like what supernatural powers could be possible. And there's a section on time travel, and they talk about Kerr rings, and you know, Jeff Jensen wrote down throne plates, but I looked up throne plates and that doesn't appear to be a thing. Or Game of Thrones is just like casted out of SEO history because I got a lot of stuff on
what
brand
are throne
time
plates?
Traveling.
Pewter.
But Kerr rings, Dave, you're a resident time travel expert. Do you know what a Kerr ring is?
No.
Okay.
I just watched this all simultaneously try to highlight and Google it on the
dial. No, I already have it. I Googled it. Good. I pre-Googled it. Okay. Kerr black holes were postulated by the theorist Roy Kerr in the 1960s. He postulated that a rotating star could collapse into a black hole with a rotating ring of neutrons at its center rather than the usual singularity. Kerr believed that since there wasn't a singularity at the center, one might be able to travel back through the black hole without being crushed by the singularity. Another theoretically possible scenario is that a person could enter the Kerr black hole and exit through a white hole on the other side. A white hole would actually push everything away from it using some form of exotic matter with negative energy. And in this way, one could travel through space-time.
Oh, interesting.
So I think it's the plot of Interstellar, I think, is what we're talking about here. Anyway, apparently people who are really dialed into time travel as this idea of like a scientific thing we can crack – you know, we're having these discussions around these episodes of Lost. So there you go.
Love it.
Kerr rings. Interesting. While we're with you, Joanna, we have a Jeff Jensen recap name award, or it's either an award or we have to guess who the character is. What are we doing this week?
You'll know it, so don't worry.
Oh, okay, sweet.
It is the Frazzled Physicist.
Oh, PH Frazzled?
if only. Frazzled Physicist Dan Faraday. It's no Time Daddy, I think you'll agree. So.
Or Physicist with PHIZ, I would also accept.
If I ever go back in time, I'm going to find Jeff Jensen and give him Time Daddy.
Give him the Time Daddy.
Time Daddy? I mean, once again, the Jeff Jensen casual, I'm not going to call him misogyny because Jeff Jensen's a wonderful person and I love him. But like, he calls Eloise Hawking a bitch in his recap. And I was just like, I don't like it.
Certainly not the episode to try to apply that to. She had a whole pendulum in a lighthouse, and you didn't call her a bitch. Oh, maybe you did. I don't know. I wasn't watching. All right. Ben's talking, so it's obviously a light award. Ben's not in this, but it does go heartbreakingly to Eloise, who says yes when Dan asks her if she really wants him to go to the island to make him proud. She just says yes, and her face twitches, and if you've already seen the episode and you're rewatching it, your heart breaks because it's a horrible lie. It's a woo-loo-loo, the best time travel moment, which is Dan straight out just tells Chang he's from the future in a real drugged-up Saeed fashion. I love it because it seems like this, like, weird thing in time travel to not, like, you know, tip the hand between the time travelies and the non-time travelies. So I like it in fiction when they just throw that rule out the window because they know what they're doing. Good job, Lost. It's time for the Jungle of Kistery moment. This is where we decide who should be kissing on Lost. Emphasis this week on the we, right, Joanna?
Yeah, okay, so a couple things happened. First of all, our history poll from last week got lost in a cur hole, I'm pretty sure.
Someone jumped through time, grabbed it, and it was gone.
Cur rings around the Hume hole.
So that means that I get to pick the winner. And I choose Miles and Fish Tacos because that was my submission. And this week we decided to make it a bloodbath, a real matchup for the ages, because we can. We've got icons of Kistery, Penny and Dez, right? Mm-hmm. No one has ever been able to beat Penny and Dez in a Kistery poll. Howevskis. entering the ring, we've got James and Juliet. They're going through some little bit of tough times here, but we're going to pit James and Juliet up against Penny and Dez, and you have to pick.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, if you choose poorly, one of you is going to die by the hands of your own mother. So choose wisely.
Like, like the titular variable, we are injecting a little bit of chaos into the Kistery, and I like it.
That is, the beauty of this episode, I'm just sort of going off the map here for a second, which is the beauty of this episode where Dan shows up and is like, I know I've been saying whatever happened for a whole time you've known me, but I've changed my mind. We can change the past. And then he just like runs straight into like a past he couldn't change. Right. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
The fact that he was always going to be killed by his mother. Ooh, tough stuff. All right.
Time is like, oh, you thought wrong.
It's me, time. I am my own daddy. The most 1977 thing no one noticed is Phil's missing. So we say Phil hasn't tweeted in 12 hours because it was dark and he went missing. And now it's light outside. And everyone's
Phil definitely
like,
would have tweeted something like, don't you think Mr. LaFleur's hair looked really nice today?
Yeah.
Don't you think no one fills out a Dharma jumpsuit better than Jim LaFleur?
No, I think it's even worse. Phil would just, he would at Sawyer, at LaFleur, and be like, you looked really nice today. So that only one person could see it, and it's LaFleur.
And they're mutuals who are like, oh, right? Phil. Oh,
but it's still in public. You know?
I'm just following them for work, but here we go.
Maybe he's created like a fake Jim LaFleur fan account that like he pretends he's not running. Anyway.
The Charlie Pace Memorial Final Words Award goes to poor Daniel Faraday, whose final words are, I'm your son.
Oh,
fucked up so final fucked words. Up. The Franklopedist, guess we're not going to Guam Act Make Award. This was a tough one. The first one chronologically that happens is I'm from the future. He says that to Chang at the Orchid Station, and we're out to commercial. The other one, he says to our losties, which is, I'm going to detonate a hydrogen bomb. Both very shocking. Dual awards from Mr. Faraday. We already did our official podcast check-in talking about throwing giant boulders in streams, so I think that means we're going to speed into the storm right after this.
This episode of The Storm is sponsored by BetterHelp. Is there something interfering with your happiness or is preventing you from achieving your goals? Y'all, can you think of anything that might have happened over the last year that's causing you some stress? I think so. Just a little. BetterHelp is here to assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. The great part is you can start communicating in just under 48 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online. And there's a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in many areas. And the service is available for clients worldwide.
If you, like me, are getting a little stressed out about the idea of going back into the world in a post-pandemic space, you can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor, and you'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. That is a big obstacle for some people in therapy, trying to find the right therapist. So the fact that you can sort of switch it up with BetterHelp is really great stuff. And this is a really good part. It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available because BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today.
That thing Joanna was talking about finding a specific counselor for you, BetterHelp makes that easy because you can visit their website and read testimonials from real people that are posted daily. For instance, here's one that was posted yesterday for their counselor, Amanda Andrews. This user says, "So glad I began this journey and I was paired with Amanda. She's guided me through a very tough year and I've come out stronger than ever. With her guidance and my family's support, I am beyond excited for the future." So if you need some support like that, you could visit betterhelp.com/storm. That's better, H-E-L-P, and join the over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp, I wonder why, that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and the Storm listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/storm.
Now is the time on the show where we like to thank our Patreon subscribers at the $10 level or above. They get everything. They get the bonus podcasts. They get the movie watches. They get the book club. They get it all. And these are they. So we would like to thank Taylor Granger, James, Dan Pozo, Stephen Lear, Jess, Amy, Mother of Dragons and Breaker of Chains, Amanda Rhodes, Natalie Gershman, and Craig Goulborn Martin, and also Susan Monk, Lindsay Mitchell and Nursey, Lex Gurnan, Sverrier Sigfusson, Ryan James, Mitch Felidia Featherbottom, Matthew Putamali, Reeve Johnson, Heather Todd, and Alex Winkus. Thank you so much.
And I would like to thank David Rinna, Frank Perinello, Jackson Clare, Max Barnhart, Rochelle Leopard, Yossi Goffman, Jorge D'Argens, Emma Maltz, Violante, Kelly Donahue, Abby Ademchek, Michael Weir, Melissa Shippey, Michael Mora, Lewis Walker, Adam Barnum, Claudia Davis, Chip Mims, Annette Maneri, and Anne Hasek. Thank you guys very much.
And I would like to thank the following lovely humans: Julie Mahoney, Brian Ohm, Will Wallace, L.M., Alexandria Wadsworth Bryce, Michael McGovern, Sophie Daly, Henry Berthelsen, Cecilia Nilsson, Jennifer Clark, Dean Tisthammer, Jose Cordova, Raymond McDaniel, G. Alex Bartice, Hannah, Will Neville, Tone Kristen Langenay, Michael Caswell, James Barta, and Zim. Thank you all for being members of the Small Council.
we're back for the storm, where we're safe from our mothers, maybe. My mom was in the live chat with us, and when Eloise gives Daniel the notebook, she's like, I used to give Dave notebooks when, you know, he was young, and it really worked out. And I'm like, Mom does not remember how this episode ends. Oof. Anyway, love me some storm time, love me some time travel, but it seems like in the era of keeping things tight, I'm no longer the best captain of the storm. Joanna, what's our spoiler talk this week?
Well, obviously we're going to talk about all the journal stuff that I thought I was going to put in the column, or we can save it for next week, but, well, we have a storm fact in here, which I suspect comes from Neil. Do you want to hit us with that storm fact?
Yeah, this is, according to Lostpedia, which is usually right about these things, this is the last episode of the series to feature flashbacks interspersed with on-island action and focused on only a single character, which is a long way of saying, like, the flashbacks that they sort of have always been doing. Like, the bulk of the flashbacks are single character focused, and they are sort of intercut with what's going on the island. We have the next episode, obviously, Follow the Leader, does not have flashbacks, and the incident has like a million flashbacks
the
from
Jacob
like a bunch
flashbacks.
Of different characters. And then season six, of course, flashes sideways, and there are two flashback episodes in season six, as you'll recall, but those break with the format in that they are entirely flashback.
Across the sea in Abiturno.
Yep, across the sea in Abiturno. Yeah. They join. I think previously we've only had a couple of those, right? The other 48 days is one of them where it's like the entire episode is all focused on the flashback. But so we can now, at least in the storm, sort of mourn one of the sort of formatting episode formats that I think is made Lost great.
Yeah.
Which is the flashbacks for individual characters. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, rest in peace, original premise of the show.
Right. Here comes
one of our commies. Yeah. One of our commies was asking, like, do we ever find out what Richard's deal is? And one of our stormies, like, sort of threaded the answer. It was just like, yes. Like, I won't tell you what it is, but yes Abiturno's coming. Oh, I'm so excited. All right, I want to revisit the question of how Charles got his money, because my theory pertains to this journal and whether or not we think Charles ever read the journal. We know that Eloise will, and I'm going to go to an email we got to actually dive into this first. Okay. Matthew wrote in with two things, and we'll start with the second, which is the journal. The variable gives me a chance to bring back up an old question. In season two, I emailed in the theory that Widmore deliberately kept Des and Penny apart, not just because he's a bad dad, but because he had the knowledge from Daniel's notebook, which meant he knew that Des would have to go to the island to save the world. I also think this is the only reason he sponsors that boat race. I don't think I really convinced you at the time, but how do you feel about it now? After Charlie's line in this episode, my relationship with Penelope is one of the things I had to sacrifice. Matthew. So, do we think Charles got to read the spoilery journal? Is the question.
I mean, we know he was on the island still, right? Until the 90s. So there's another, like, what, 20 years there? Almost.
Well, right. But the question is only, did Eloise show him the journal? Did Eloise have this conversation with him or not?
Yeah, because if, like, well, I guess it depends necessarily what the journal, you know, what the contents of the journal are, because Dan's very science focused and then also very island and time focused. So, like, does it have specifics about Desmond's Penny? Or does it just have Desmond Hume is my constant? And because in which case, you know, is it like Charles Widmore is giving a job interview and he looks down and just like, oh my God, it's Desmond Hume. Like, this guy's coming to ask my daughter out. Like, I don't know if it makes it more dramatic if Desmond, if he knew about Desmond. But I do think that he thinks he had to sacrifice Penny to the island just in his way of thinking about things. In the same way that, like, once you're a leader, you have, like, this weird idea of what the island wants, and then you decide to serve that. I don't know how Widmore gets his. I guess in theory, he could have talked to Jacob before he talks to Jacob in the 2000s or whatever. But I'm going to say, I'm going to say no, just because it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel right to me that Daniel's math would somehow have answers for Charles Widmore.
Follow-up question. How do you feel about my theory, which is that Charles Widmore got his fortune a la Biff from reading hot stock tips from Daniel Faraday's Time Journal?
Could also work. He could also have patented pull tab beer cans, as we've seen. There's some things on the island that just, you know, don't exist off the island. I don't think it necessarily has to be a physics equation, but it could, because he does, you know, show Chang some equation that won't be discovered for like a decade or something.
Okay. I think I have a third theory.
Okay.
Eloise kept the journal, the full contents of the journal to herself. But in order to, for whatever reason, whether it was to ally with Charles or whether it was to, you know, try to throw Charles off or control him in some way, as he was going rogue and having a family off the island, she gave him a little bit of information that would, that he was then able to use. And it also would have helped like solidify Charles as like, you know, as like someone who he's not really like working with Eloise. He's not really helping her, but he's also not messing with Eloise, right? Like he doesn't seem like he wants to start a fight with her, because he knows that he seems to like have this deference for her. And, you know, that could just be that he was a shitty partner and had a family off the island, but it also could be like, oh, she gave me information that helped me build this fortune when I left the island. She's a serious time player here. You know,
I love the idea that Charles maybe stole a peek at the journal.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that got him in a fight with Eloise. This is all fan fiction, since we don't get to find out, right? But like one of the things that gets him excommunicated from the island is like using time journal knowledge to bet on the ponies or something like that. And they're like, clearly you don't have a commitment to Sparkle Motion. You are obsessed with money and with, you know, boinking someone off island. So get out of here. I, Benjamin Linus, am far more high-minded than you.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, I mean, I even think the Desmond thing, there is room for it. Like, let's say Charles is like, gets a look at this journal and is flipping through it really quickly and just sees the name Desmond Hume. I think that would panic him enough to sort of explain why he is trying to keep, at when we first meet him, why he's trying to keep Desmond and Penny apart. Cause he's like, well, shit, I don't want Penny wrapped up in this. So I don't want her to have anything to do with Desmond. So maybe, I don't know, that we're probably giving Charles Widmore way more credit than he deserves.
Well, I think they're trying to soften him as a villain figure in this episode. Mm-hmm. That conversation that he has with Eloise outside the hospital, right? Like, I think that's all part of that. But the journal, as a source of information for the others, how the others are able to be a step ahead of certain things, and certainly Eloise, like, you know, she has this line in this episode for the first time in a long time. I don't know what happens next. Because all of her predictive stuff was based on the freaking journal, right?
That she took off the dead body of her son.
Now she's all out of journal. Do we think she had a perfect copy of that journal made? Like, is that where she got, you know? Or did she have to, like, troll all the stationery stores to find the one that, you know, because she couldn't go online, really, not at the time. And like Google.
Oh, I bet it's something that like Time put it in front of her. So like she sees that journal everywhere, right? Like every airport, every whatever. And then finally there's like a graduation thing and she goes to get like a graduation gift. She's going to do something dumb like a watch. And she walks by the fucking bookstore and there's the journal. And she's like, oh, or, it's fucking Time.
Or whatever information she gives Charles causes him to start the company that makes those journals.
That makes the journals.
So she knows where she's going to get it eventually.
Whitmore Industries, maker of the Moleskine Journal.
All right, let's start. Let's do a couple more emails. One comes from Jenny, And I'm calling this email Jenny and the Hatch.
Boom. Hatch.
Bunch. Boom. All right. So Jenny writes in, "Hey guys, I have a random question about the location of the Swan. In season one, when the Hatch is first discovered, Boone and Locke have been walking the island looking for Claire all day long. It's now nighttime and they have presumably been walking the entire day. I remember thinking the Hatch must be so far away because of that episode. At least a day's walk. Boone and Locke were not on their way back to the beach camp either. I remember this distinctly because Boone was saying, 'Let's turn around and go back to camp.' And Locke was like, 'No, I'm going to keep going.' Locke tells Boone to go back to camp, but he's going to keep going and gives Boone his flashlight, which he drops, and that is how the Hatch is discovered. Were they just going in circles then? Because then, in season two, once they're inside and they start pushing the button, they make it seem like it's about a mile and a half away from the beach camp. 30 minutes walk at most. And Lost fan maps put the Swan very close to the beach camp, probably because of all those subsequent episodes in which they easily walk to and from the beach and the Hatch. Watch it being built in season 5 reminds me of this question because I feel like season 5 also makes it feel very far away from the beach camp. Potentially just a continuity error or something the show thought we wouldn't notice, but it bothers me every single rewatch. What do you all think? Another thing that I've been wondering about is Ben's culling. When he murdered the whole Dharma Initiative, presumably Radzinski and his partner were just chilling in the Swan, blissfully unaware that the rest of the Initiative was just mass murdered. Did Ben not know about the Swan and not care? Again, season 5 make it seem like at any given moment, Dharma Initiative members are all over the island in different places and inside of different stations. How did Ben decide that the barracks is the best place to do it? And what about the stragglers like those in the Swan? Just something else I've been thinking about. Thanks, Jenny." So first of all, number one, where is that Hatch, Dave?
I think the Hatch is close to the beach camp, despite the... basically, I think it's like when you first move to a new neighborhood and you're like, I'm going to walk to the grocery store. And you do, and you're like, you know what? This grocery store was further away than I was. But the reality is you're always going to the grocery store. So like after you've lived there for a year, you're just like... And then I walk to the grocery store, and you almost forget the walk. I think that's the time distancing that's, or the distance shortening that's happening in Lost, where it's always been like a couple of hours away, like just beyond the caves, by some time. But they had to like shorten it for like some story purposes, so we don't see people walking all the time. Like in the episode where Boone dies. They get him back to the caves, and then Locke just kind of like turns around and goes back. But it doesn't seem like he's been carrying him for hours or anything. So I'm going to say like close to the beach, about 30 minutes to an hour walk away.
I actually think it might even be closer than that. And I think because once they've discovered the Hatch and they're in the Hatch, it doesn't seem to take them very long to get back and forth. And... it also makes sense to me because when we first encounter the Hatch, it's almost completely buried, right? And the secondary entrance to the Hatch is also sort of like covered up. So it's kind of funny to me that like they spent a lot of time walking by that Hatch. Like they walked by it a lot and never noticed it and never found it until, you know, they stumbled upon it. So I don't know. It makes sense, and I also think that it makes sense that like it's sort of a secret location in the 1970s Dharma, and it's like it's very far away from the barracks. They're building it over a pocket of energy, so they didn't really get to choose the location of the Swan. But I feel like most of what we're seeing about it in the 1970s is that it's not super close to Dharmaville.
That means in this episode, Dan and Miles zip down to the Swan, right?
Mm-hmm.
In their jeeps.
Right.
And then zip back. And according to most maps, the barracks and the Swan are on two opposite ends of the island.
Sure.
Okay.
But maybe in the 70s they had roads back and forth.
Well, we're going. We don't need any roads.
And those roads no longer exist in 2004.
All right. How about the Ben culling? What do you think was... where was Radzinski when the Dharma Initiative was slaughtered? And where does this idea of the you know, quarantine contamination thing come from?
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, the quarantine contamination thing would make sense that if there were Dharma people in the salon, like down in the salon working, and Ben gassed everyone, and they couldn't figure out sort of exactly what happened, that they might interpret that as needing to quarantine, if that makes sense. So then, like, it just creates this, like, little bubble in the Swan that is, like, ongoing until Desmond gets there, whereas, like, they think the rest of the island is dead. It's like that Brendan Fraser movie where he's underground, where they think that the nuclear bomb killed everybody.
Past, sure.
Right? they have no information inside the Swan for some reason. I don't know. But Ben would have known about it, right? He was not only like an integral adult part of the Dharma initiative at that point, but he was also very much an other by then.
I've just decided that this is Ben's elaborate prank on Radzinski, who sucks, and he's right. Somehow like
he left Radzinski in there to believe that the whole island had been destroyed by a chemical attack.
He's on hatch duty, and Ben like radios in a video, and he's like, Radzinski, you gotta stay in there. It's contaminated. And then he pans to like all the dead bodies. Like, look, everyone's dead. The air is poisoned. Stay inside forever. Mm-hmm. All right.
And Radzinski seems like the kind of guy who would A, believe that, and B, react very poorly to that information.
God, I hate that guy. All right. anything else about that?
No, I like the idea that it happened and then they sort of pranked Radzinski and told him it was quarantined. That feels right.
And then prank ends in suicide.
The only question I'm feeling weird about now is how Kelvin gets in there given that prank, but maybe mm-hmm. it's also a psychological experiment at that point.
Mm-hmm. All right, this email is from Derek. And then we've got the other half of Matthew's email, and it's all about the Egypt stuff, all right? So this is called What's Up with Egypt? After last week's discussion about when the Egyptians came to the island, I decided I absolutely had to share my thoughts. I love that we just get the hints about the island's history in this regard, as it implies that things didn't just start with Jacob or even his mother, and implies a long, rich history going back millennia. I always took the Cork and Jacob as predating Jacob and Smokey. Jacob and his mother seemed to be Roman, and Rome came to power long after ancient Egypt's few thousand years of prosperity. Therefore, chronologically, the Egyptian ruins should already be on the island when Jacob's Latin-speaking bio-mom arrives. While some hieroglyphics show a smoke monster, this doesn't mean that they are showing the man in black we see on the show. In fact, Allison Janney seems to know that the light can create a smoke monster, implying it has definitely happened before, and some have theorized that she might be the one herself. I can see the island as being parallel with the history of humanity. For hundreds of thousands of years, the light on the island existed undisturbed, until the advent of agriculture, when humans stopped being hunter-gatherers and formed the first civilizations, including Egypt. Some of these people made their way to the island and tried to take the light. This caused an incident, which may have birthed the first smoke monster, and the Egyptians had to build a cork to hold back the light. This represents that humanity can never return to a time before it changed everything. Something like this would have happened again when the incident occurred, which took place because of an atom bomb, another moment in history when humanity had created something that would change the world forever and constantly put it in danger. Anyway, that's just how I see it. TLDR, Egypt predates Rome, so the Egypt stuff was there before the Latin-speaking Jacob. Keep up all the great work. I look forward to the podcast all week. Don't ever tighten up, Derek. Okay. So Derek says, Egyptians first, then Allison Janney, then Jacob and the man in black. What do you guys think?
Yes, I like this. You know why I actually like this more is because then we could get like some pre-Zoroastrianism like religion and people and thinkers on the island, right? Because like the whole one is light and one is dark gets, you know, echoed in the brothers or whatever, but it's also kind of split into this idea of like heaven and hell, and Zoroastrianism was the first religion to sort of like split into like those good and bad dichotomies with like a singular god, whereas it's like Egyptian religions are much more complex and they're much more based around like specific gods for specific things, and they aren't necessarily all benevolent gods. And so I like that the first encounter with the island, that there could be a pre Western religion time period of the island. I like that idea. And it also makes a lot of the candidates and Jesus imagery and resurrection stuff that we've seen in this time around the wheel for Lost feel like it is just, you know, sort of like the Roman base, like the island will meet whoever it's testing at their own time period. So if you meet somebody with a American ascendant society, of course it's going to be a plane full of a whole bunch of Americans, or American adjacent peace and people in the case of the Kwans. But like, yeah, I like it. I think we see enough evidence to support it. I definitely am looking forward to getting back to Across the Sea, because the idea that the moms smoke monsters and kills that other settlement is something that was brought up in emails since the last time I've rewatched it. So I like that idea for sure. Yeah, I don't think there's anything in that email I don't like. Good job, Derek.
Here comes Matthew, who emailed and said, just to follow up on my email last week about the Quark, the idea comes from the audio commentary on Across the Sea, where Damon suggests that the apparatus we see in the finale with the stone sticking in the middle of the pool that's sort of blocking the light wasn't created until after this event. And Carlton describes that as an incredibly likely deduction. So some fans talk about an ancient incident where the Egyptians, much like Dharma, go digging in parts of the island with mysterious properties, unleash properties beyond their comprehension, and have to stick a cork in it to make the problems go away.
Yeah, yeah. So, didn't they stick the wheel in the other problem area? But that's the one that Man in Black like helped with.
That means Alice and Janney, then Egyptians. And what Derek's email presupposed was Egyptians, then Alice and Janney.
Either so way,
everyone built the cork is the question.
Everyone ends up with an incident on this island.
Who put the bob in the bob to bob, and who put the cork in the middle of the golden pool? Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, a question. All right, here's the question that I have for you. and this is based on a conversation I was having with someone about like the satisfaction of paying off a what does it all mean mystery, right?
Okay.
And this person supposed that the payoff of a what does it all mean mystery doesn't land well unless it is connected to the emotional journey of a character that we care about. So, for example, like with WandaVision, it matters to us what's happening in the bubble, because it's going to matter to Wanda to figure out what is real and what is not, and how to grieve and how to heal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or in something like The Leftovers, something I love about that is that the ambiguity of the mystery at the end of Leftovers is baked into the relationship between Kevin and Nora. And like the ambiguity that it leaves on is tied up in their connection to each other and finding each other. But the problem with Lost in the end, and we all know I like the finale, but I think the problem about the mystery feeling unsatisfying is that the only person that really, really cared about what does it all mean on the island was John Locke. And he's dead by the time we learn a lot of these things. And so we just have like fake John Locke showing, we have Smokey showing Sawyer the cave, or we have Jack seeing the lighthouse. And like Jack is in a sort of a surrogate John Locke position at that point, but all of those revelations would matter so much more if it were a Locke who is the one who cared the most about the mystery of the island and tied the mystery of the island so closely to his own like journey of healing. And so I think we haven't really talked about this a lot, because I think that we love Terry O'Quinn's performance, like the duality of what he plays as the Man in Black is really fun, but I think it's a mistake to not have John Locke alive in the final chapter of The Island. What do you guys think?
I don't know if I would agree with exactly how you just put it, because I think that although the thesis is correct, that by you have to link a character's emotional journey to the mystery solving thing. But again, I think the danger in treating Locke as correct when really he's the person that always makes the wrong decision because of his faith is less powerful to reward him for that than having Jack switch to the Locke position. I think making the man of science the man of faith is a cooler trick than putting the man of faith through a lot of shit.
Not saying that he has to be right about it. Like, he could be wrong. But, like, the thing that goes out of balance is once you take Locke off the board, the audience's desire for mystery resolution always outweighs the character's desire for mystery resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what puts you off balance. The same thing is true in, like Westworld season one, that mystery is tied to Dolores' awakening, right? And then in later seasons of Westworld, it just becomes a Michigas designed to, like, baffle the audience. And when it's not got that emotional through line, when it's out of balance like that, when it's just the Reddit detectives trying to figure out what's going on, then any resolution or lack of resolution feels hollow and weird and just like an intellectual exercise rather than an emotional fulfillment. And I think that emotional fulfillment does not necessarily need to land where Locke is right about everything. In fact, I think it's better when he's not right about everything. But I think we would want him there in the end to be like, am I just a pawn for you shitty gods in your game? Fuck you. You know what I mean? Like, we want that moment.
I kind of like this. Yeah. Because, okay, so this is one of the things that I have long struggled to sort of understand at, like, an emotional level, which is why were people so mad at the end of Lost.
Yeah.
Because I don't remember being mad at the show, right? But when it comes to getting the answers, it is, like, you're right. If it's just, do I want answers? That's not super compelling, because I don't need all the answers, you know, to all the things. Like, my mind has already spun up, like, 4 spinoffs for Lost that answer any questions that I would have. But I can see, and I can, like, empathize with someone who was really rooting for John Locke to figure things out on this island. And John Locke is the character who is robbed of the answers. Like, if you're going to be mad that somebody didn't get answers, it is John Locke, because he never gets to know what it was all for. He never really gets to know much about the power of the island, other than that he believes in it and it helped him overcome his being in a wheelchair and his terrible, terrible injury. But there are a lot of answers at the end of Lost that John Locke would have been an interesting person to have in the room. And I do think that it is that, yeah, I can see where people would turn the other direction and be like, it's not fair to John that he didn't get the answers. And it's kind of weird for the audience because he's still technically there in, like, physical form, but it's not him. It's a totally new character, inhabiting his body, basically.
But he gets to go in the church in the end anyway. And
sure.
Wouldn't us see more of the same, which is Locke thinks he knows the answers until he meets the person that has the actual answer and then he's frustrated by it? I think that would just be more frustrating. Like,
well, and
Locke,
I mean,
wins ultimately. That's the cheat or the success of Sky Church, all religion Sky Church. Right, is that the relationships they made on the island ended up being the things that mattered. It doesn't matter they saved the world. It doesn't matter that, you know, he murdered his father, you know, or Sawyer murdered his father. He gets to go in the church.
Yeah, but you're talking about the Flash sideways, and Locke's emotional journey through the Flash sideways is enormously rewarding. That's why a lot of the final season works, is like the Locke stuff in there, the Jack stuff in there, all the Flash sideways. But when you get to, like, the on-island, like, there's a light in a cave and you got to drink from a thing in the stream that leads down there. And
yes,
blah, blah.
I think there's a difference. I think if John Locke were, like, turned to Jack and is like, Jack, we have to protect the light, I think I'd be like, this is a step too fucking far. This is the guy who learned his lesson with the button. Like, John Locke was looking for answers, and a magic light that's going to save all of humanity is not the answer John Locke was looking for.
Mm-hmm. I think the argument is, would it have been more interesting for the show to be able to have that moment where we get to know what John Locke's reaction would be? I think it's like, it's that ultimately John was denied answers about the island's mythology, just like the audience, making him sort of a perfect vessel for anyone who was mad about not getting the answers to the island mythology, because it's like, it is the most, seems to be the most unfair to John by the end, because he from the moment he was able to wiggle his toes after that crash, was the most invested in getting answers about what the island is and what it wants and all that stuff. So yeah, I can see it. I think the show's message by the end is like, that stuff didn't matter. Like, it was the human connections, the character right. connections, and that still works really well. But I kind of like this as like, this does the death of John Locke and sort of what they do with him leading up to this finale might have been what took people on that divergent path where they're just like, I'm not getting the answers I wanted, you know. And like John Locke, I feel like the show died with me at the end of season four, you
and
know.
And not only that, but even the answers that I'm getting, like, here's a temple, here's a lighthouse, here's a statue, here's a whatever, is not hitting me emotionally. And that's because we don't have like the moments where John Locke like looks down the hatch or sees the Beechcraft or finds the question mark hatch or, you know, like all those moments of just sort of like wonder and awe that Terry O'Quinn delivers. I'm missing those in the moments of discovery in the final season where Sawyer's like, okay, so the fuck what? So a bunch of our names are written on a wall in a cave and there's a weird, like, whatever here. Like, it doesn't, you know, or Jack being angry about the lighthouse. Like, it doesn't hit in the same emotionally satisfying way as those other revelations did. And so, furthering my fan fiction. It's okay if we can agree or disagree about this, and we can also continue discussing this, and I would love to hear what people think about this if they want to email us. But my follow-up prompt would be, if it's not Terry O'Quinn playing the smoke monster, who should do it? And my answer is Elizabeth Mitchell. Like, if you're going to kill Juliet down the hatch, can you imagine, like, serene, creepy, evil Juliet Mitchell, Elizabeth Mitchell as Juliet Smokey? I can. I'm into it.
She'd be like a smoky velociraptor. Uh-huh. Terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, it would hurt less if you called her a smoky velociraptor if she didn't not get to do that because she was in V, which is about aliens pretending to be humans who are lizards. Yeah, man, that would have been good. I thought you were going to go like way out there, be like, and then Alan Rickman shows up, and I'd be like, ooh, hey, a weird smoke monster person.
The second Don answer is Johnson. Definitely Mikhail, right?
Don Johnson. It's Mikhail. It's Mikhail. You see, I did not die because I smoke monster. Horrible accent.
It's Boo. Bring back Ian Somerhalder going full vampire dummies, which he's so good on, and just have him be like super evil Boone. Evil mm-hmm. Boone.
Yes.
And Shannon. He's both.
Boone, I mean, it could have also just been Christian Shepherd, right? Like, even if they killed off, I mean, maybe John Locke's still there, but like, can you imagine the fight at the end being Jack against his own father?
Dad. Oh my god, yes.
Give me back my shoes, son.
Like, I feel like maybe that's too on the nose, but also would have been fun.
Falcon punch. All right, that's all the stormy stuff I have. Looks like Dave and I are in a disagreement. Neil is chilling in a neutral territory. Sounds about right. But yeah, if you guys want to email us, host the Storm Podcast, your thoughts of like, should they have kept John around? And would that have helped some of the like,
you know what?
Mystery stuff land?
I'm not on neutral territory for this one. I'm going to say yes. They should have kept John Locke as John Locke. I like this idea.
Oh.
I mean, I don't super dislike him as the smoke monster. Like, the fun reveal that he's been like playing Richard at the end of this season is pretty wild, but I think it would have been better if they left him as John Locke, or like even if they had to kill him and bring him back, but like that is actually John Locke, I think would have been interesting.
I agree.
Well,
sorry, Dave.
Oh, that's fine. I mean,
Harper is the man in black.
Harper is the man in black. We don't know for sure that Harper wasn't the man in black.
It's true.
It's true. With our discovery last week that Twitter was around at this point, I tried to go back and figure out what my earliest Lost tweet was, and it was basically me saying that the new man in charge was dumb. So That's how long that opinion has existed. When we get to answers without connection to any sort of character, I guess it is sort of connected to Walt and Hurley, but outside of that, it's a videotape that Ben plays with Dr. Chain on it.
Mm-hmm.
Something I forgot to say in the comm, and I should have, and I meant to, and I even wrote a note for myself to do so, is that our live watch of the finale is going to be a two-parter on the 17th. We're all going to be there for it. It's going to be 2 hours. So
it's going to be wild. Yeah.
I should have said that earlier. Yeah. We'll say it again next week.
Jacob's off-island tour. Here we go.
Yep, and then everybody's going to sit and wonder what the flash to white means, and then, you know, we get to relive that part of our lives.
Jacob mm-hmm. touches children. Touched by a Jacob.
Touched by a Jacob.
I don't like any of that. Neil, where are we going next week before we get touched by a Jacob?
Next week, we're going with the aforementioned Richard as he follows the leader. It's called Follow the Leader. And I think this is... Is this the one that ends with the reveal? The John reveal?
Of the
body?
That
he's not who he says he is? No, I think it's the next one. Or maybe it is this one. I don't know. We'll find out next week.
That's right.
What this episode is. It is a Richard episode. Can't have enough of those, in my opinion. So it'll be fun.
And until next week, where can people find more of your work online? Joanna Robinson.
This week you can hear me guest appearing on the Ringerverse podcast, talking about Falcon the Winter Soldier. You can hear me on my own podcast, still watching, talking about Falcon the Winter Soldier. And you can hear me interview Minari director Lee Isaac Chung on Little Gold Men. So also on Twitter at Joe Wrote This.
And Mr. Neil Miller.
Well, you know, I always do some work over there at filmschoolrejects.com or on Twitter at rejects at One Perfect Shot. And if you're a member of our Patreon Slack, patreon.com/stormspoilers for that, you can watch The Legend of Korra with me. We just started it this week, so very easy to catch up. I am watching it for the first time. It is a blast so far, and you should join us.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can also find me in the Fighting in the War Room podcast, where this week we made David Ehrlich watch Godzilla vs. Kong, and he hated it, and I loved making him hate it. You can find that wherever fantastic podcasts are found. And you can also find me right here at the end of every episode, reminding you to not fall down.